This is an RNIB Connect radio podcast.
Hello, I'm Toby Davey and welcome to Tracks of My Life here on RNIB Connect Radio. In Tracks of My Life, we invite a guest to select a few tracks that mean something to them and mark important moments in their life, from maybe that first track they ever heard, right through to one track that they would like to pass on but might give people hope for the future or maybe just inspire them. My guest today is former Paralympian Jonathan Ward, who won a number of Paralympic medals as a visually impaired athlete, including a gold in the shot put, silver in the discus, and a bronze in the pentathlon at the Seoul Games in 1988, a bronze in the shot put at the Barcelona Games in 1992, and another bronze in the shot put at the Sydney 2000 Games. Hello, Jonathan, and welcome to Tracks of My Life here on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hi, Toby. Nice to meet you.
Jonathan, I believe your earliest musical memory is of a classical piece of music and the third movement of Tchaikovsky's Symphony No. 6. What age were you when you first heard this wonderful piece of music? And was it on the radio in a car journey, or was it on a record player at home?
So, to be honest, it's probably what you would call a pre-memory. So my understanding is that this is the piece of music, or one of the pieces of music, that my parents used to play to me to make me go to sleep. So I started off with the first movement, which I haven't chosen today, but actually it's the first movement that they used to play. And what happens is it's a very, very quiet intro. And then he used to slam, it comes in with a very loud crescendo, which also used to wake me up, which was a bit counterintuitive, apparently. But over my early years, this is a piece of music was often played around the house. And throughout the years, the third movement, every time something sort of momentous in my life has happened, bizarrely, this piece of music has happened in the background. So whether it be sort of like at the birth of a child or getting my A-level results or something, it's always happened to be on the radio or just appeared in the background somewhere along the line, which is a really weird coincidence.
And was classical music something that your parents listened to that was sort of on in at the house sort of kind of thing?
Yeah, so I think as you probably see from my list of music, I think I grew up in a fairly eclectic music household. So classical music was probably one of the main genres. And when I looked at all the record collection, predominantly probably about 75% were classical.
And you obviously say that, you know, this piece of music comes on when something that's sort of life-changing happens with you and, you know, sort of maybe for yourself, for your family and stuff. Was there a particular life-changing moment apart from your birth that you can remember hearing this piece of music?
It wasn't my birth. It was sort of like around the birth of my first child that the music came on. But obviously I can choose the play now. I could just say the magic words and it would appear magically through my smart speaker. But it doesn't happen like that. It happens sort of spontaneously. It's sort of like if my life was a film, it'd be like the backdrop music that suddenly appears on the radio or the TV or something. So it's just that connection, and I have no idea why that happens. As my teacher phoned me up with my A-level results, then it came on. As I learnt that I was going to be a father, it was on in the background. It's that sort of connection, you know, that happens. And I have no idea. And it's always the third movement. But I can't obviously influence. I can't play the third movement and have a magical event occur. It has to be spontaneous and out of my control.
There we have the wonderful Tchaikovsky's Symphony No. 6 and the third movement, and a memorable piece of music that does sort of punctuate your life, Jonathan. We are now moving to a very different piece of music for your next track, and one that marks, as you say, a sort of safe family place for you and a springboard to trying new things too. Jonathan, what new things were you trying at this time? And why do you sort of say that the track marks a safe family place for you?
So I think we're talking about an old lady who swallowed a fly, aren't we? So I guess for me, I guess for me, it's that sort of feeling that you can do any new activity as long as you've got a safe place to go back to. So anyone can try anything adventurous or brave or take on a new sport or a new challenge if you've got somewhere to go back to and people who say, well, it didn't work out, so never mind. And then you can try something different in the future. And I just think that actually this piece of music probably marks something like that, because it's that probably one of the first pieces of music. So my dad had aspirations to be a singer, used to sing to us in the bath. And this is one of the songs he used to sing to us when we were small. And probably the only song actually I know all the words to, I think.
And was there sort of, you know, at a time when, you know, sort of you were maybe starting to lose your sight a bit that this sort of piece of music marks?
Not so much. It's probably before that. But I think actually probably as my sight started to deteriorate, probably around the age of 10 or 11, I probably moved a little bit away from this. But it's that place of security. It just sort of reminds me really that it's that place of strength, that place of, okay, so it's okay, my child is losing their sight, but we just have to make the most of it and we just have to get on with it. And yes, he's got to go away to special school, but actually, you know, that's not a disaster in the long term. We're just going to find our way of dealing with this situation. And I think it's that sort of springboard, that sense of security, that launch pad for whatever activity, you know, whether it be losing your sight and all that brings, and then going away to special school.
And, you know, sort of, I suppose, I think we're possibly of a similar vintage in a way, Jonathan, because I went to a special school as well. I mean, did you and your parents sort of think that that was the best option for you at the time?
I guess, when I look back now, obviously with a lifetime of experience, so you see now, my sight loss was only detected in what's now what they call year six, so the end of primary school. So I went going into the September of year six, the end of primary school, I started to not be able to see the blackboard, so I couldn't see the red chalk on the board. If people remember chalk on blackboards, if you're old enough, so I couldn't see that. My teacher then sort of, as they do, you know, obviously I moved to the front of the class and then contacted my parents, had the optician's kit, and went through that whole rigmarole. So, but within a year of tests and hospital appointments and things, I was actually in special school. So I don't know that choices were there. It was just, this looks like the best option, so just go for it. So if you can imagine it's only a year, which is quite a short space of time to go from sort of what was going, you know, an anticipated trip to the nearest secondary school to going 150 miles away to school. So that was a quick turnaround for everybody.
And I suppose sort of going back to that sort of time, I mean, special schools were possibly the best option at that time, weren't they?
Yeah. So for me, and as we move on, I think for me, I met fantastic friends. Obviously, I guess I'd never really met anyone with sight loss. And I think throughout my career, obviously, I've worked with people with sight loss, blind and partial sighted people for the best part of 40 years. But this is, at that point, I was the only person. Like many people, you feel that you're on your own and it's all happening to you. So obviously you go away, you meet other people, you learn you're not on your own, you learn how to manage your life or your aspects of life as someone who has, you know, limited vision. And it, for me, it was never an excuse not to do anything or try anything. So I think that was a really good environment that I found myself in.
I know an old lady who swallowed a fly. I don't know why she swallowed a fly. Perhaps she'll die. I know an old lady who swallowed a spider that wriggled and jiggled and tickled inside her. She swallowed a spider to catch the fly, but I don't know why she swallowed the fly. Perhaps she'll die.
Wow, that track, I think, takes us all back to times from a long time ago as well. But very, very good it is too. We are now moving, Jonathan, to your time at school. And was this the first time you really got into, I suppose, sport and maybe more into the way of, I suppose, taking part in competitions for visually impaired children?
Yeah, so So I explained that I had that sort of like that wild year of transitioning from sort of mainstream primary into school. And I explained about all the tests and things. I'd always done lots of sports at school. So I played for the primary school football team and swam in the swim galas and just pretty much we even did country dancing and things. But actually, as my sight deteriorated for about 6 months, I was actually banned from doing any sport at all because they felt there was a risk to losing all my sight, which was not the case. There was no risk at all. But at that point, they were ruling out every opportunity, everything. So I did have to go for a period of not doing any sport. And then you realise when you don't have something, you realise how much you miss it. So when I went to school, to Exel Grange School, took every opportunity to pick that up. So there was a weight training club and we played football, house football leagues, gym football, all sorts of activities, table tennis. So pretty much whatever was on offer, I sort of took up, really.
The track that you have chosen that marks this time, Jonathan, is Eton Rifles by The Jam. Were you a big fan of The Jam at the time and aware of some of the politics that they were talking about in their songs?
No, I was oblivious. To be honest, I didn't even particularly like The Jam at the time. So, and it's only recently, because now when I go to the gym, I quite often listen to The Jam when I'm sitting on the exercise bike, because I look back at this time. But actually, I've realised how actually clever some of the lyrics of The Jam are and how politically much, but I was totally unaware. All I can remember, and the reason I chose this song pretty much is I'd never been to a disco before or any sort of social event. And this was probably the first one I ever went to. This track was playing and everyone was pogoing around and it was a lot of fun.
Yeah. And I think those sort of first sort of experiences as a teenager and stuff and things are always the sort of the ones that stick in your memory. And are there any apart, you know, after the discos as well, but are there any sort of moments of that teenage time that Exel that come back to you when you hear Eton Rifles?
I just think this sort of the music was on in the background all the time. So I think for me, if you can imagine, I think in our house there was 50. There's about when I first went there was about 50 boys from the age of probably actually five. There was from 5 to sort of 20 years of age, and pretty much every single room I guess in the house. So I think there was just trying to remember probably close to 15 rooms in the house, and every single room had a different genre of music coming out. But obviously, I remember two groups really that sort of stick in my mind were the Sex Pistols and the Jam. Really, that was because they were possibly because they played at quite a loud volume. So so those are the two sorts of genres of music which really, or two groups, which sort of were loud and stick in my memory and was all like almost on a loop, really. And the background to my sort of first 3-4 years of being at school.
Classic Jam there with Eton Rifles and early school days, well, teenage school days for you, Jonathan. We now come to a track, Jonathan, that marks the time when you were competing for Great Britain at the Atlanta Paralympic Games in 1996. This was not your first Paralympic Games, as you had competed at the Seoul 1998 and Barcelona 1992 Paralympic Games. So what was it like sort of leading up and going into your third Paralympic Games? What's the sort of training like? Because I know there's like a 4-year cycle from one Games to another.
I think, as you say, so we're talking about the 1996 Games in particular, but I think my life probably from about 1985, when I was sort of first had this sort of opportunity really to start looking at international sport. I guess what you do is you focus your life around training. Possibly that becomes very important in their lives. And even now, I still go to the gym or do some sort of activity every day because it's sort of ingrained. So I got very much into the habit of going to the gym or going to the track or doing something. So it became a competitive lifestyle, really. So weekends away, training. So Yeah, so by 1996, I think they've probably been doing this for about 11 years. But I guess it's also very bizarre, because I think it's a strange way of living, because your whole year or 4 year cycles, as you allude to, is focused on one day, one event, really. So for me, a couple of days in a 4 year cycle. So I would spend a whole 4 years, or pretty much 4 years, focused on being at my peak and actually achieving my best performance on a given day in every 4 years. And at that point, there weren't that many opportunities for athletes with disabilities to compete. So it really was, you know, take that chance, focus on that one day. And I remember sitting on the plane all the way to Korea thinking, yeah, I'm going, you know, pretty much all the way around the world, and I have to perform to my best. Otherwise, I'm going to be letting myself down and letting down a whole host of people who've invested a lot of time and effort in me. So it's a bizarre thought. And of course, then you have to think, actually, well, I've got to lose those thoughts. And so any negative thoughts or any thoughts that could impact on your performance, you have to lose. But it's really hard when you're sitting at sort of 35,000 feet and you're traveling all day to think, I'm going an awful long way for just a few seconds of performance, and I've got to achieve my very best. Yeah, so it's a different way of life.
Yeah, and I suppose it must be hard when you're away from family as well, you know, sort of, I mean, as you say, on the other side of the world almost, kind of stuff, which must be hard.
Only when I went to Sydney in 2000 did we had email. So before that, it was find a phone box and phone home and just remember it's the right time, you know. So I got to work out. So when I was phoning, I remember phoning my grandparents from Seoul, for example, in 1988, and with a long distance call, isn't it? So no mobiles, no easy access. So it was very, very different. I think I might have even sent a postcard, but don't hold me to that.
And I know you sort of competed in track and field, discus and shot put and javelin and 400 metres and stuff and things. Had you sort of changed sports at all over that time for competing?
So my main events have always been throwing events. But I guess that when we went to the first Paralympics, I don't know, it's a very different culture. It was possibly a very different culture, and obviously I was a lot younger and a lot fitter. So I think at that Paralympics I was entered for a lot of events, not the 400 metres which you mentioned, but pretty much it felt like everything else. So I actually medalled in the shot put, discus, and then we also did a multi-event. So it's like a pentathlon, which is five events. So you do that as well. Yeah. So I also did the javelin there as well, as you alluded. So a lot of events. So a very busy 2 weeks in Korea in 88. By the time I got to Australia in 2000, I was down to two events. So it was just the shot and the discus.
And the track that you have chosen, Jonathan, that does mark your time coming back from the Atlanta 1996 Games, is Wannabe by the Spice Girls, who certainly burst onto the scene at that time. They were a bit of a force, you know, with girl power and everything else. But I think there's something in their songs, you know, sort of, it's not just for girls, it's also for, you know, people, you know, you can be what you want to be.
So, the truth is, I'm not a Spice Girls fan, but actually when I came back, I had three daughters at the time, and they were aged, I think, five and four. So twins of four. My eldest daughter was five when I arrived back. I'd never heard of the Spice Girls, but when I came back, very much this is the track that they were leaping about to, like lunatics, and they really, really enjoyed the Spice Girls. And I know if the opportunity arises, or if the Spice Girls ever reform or put in another appearance, they'll be at that concert. But so this is my memory of that time coming home to see them leaping about like lunatics to this piece of music. I would say that some of my Paralympic team contemporaries did actually have an audience with the Spice Girls. I wasn't invited, so I know some of them speak very fondly of spending time with the Spice Girls, but I missed out on that opportunity myself. I'll tell you what I want. What I really, really want. Don't tell me what you want, what you really, really want. I wanna really, really, really wanna sing as it. If you wanna be my lover, you gotta get with my friends. Make it last forever. Friendship never.
the Spice Girls there and Wannabe, which certainly made its mark back there in the mid-1990s. We now move forward from the 1996 Atlanta Paralympic Games to the 2000 Sydney Paralympic Games. If my memory is correct, I think that there was a lot of sort of talk about the Sydney Paralympic Games being the biggest and best Paralympic Games at that time. And I wondered, as an athlete, did you get a sense of that as you were preparing for the Sydney 2000 Games?
Yes, I think so. I did a radio interview at the time, and I remember saying it was like, maybe it was the change in technology, maybe it was the change in attitude. But it was like, even though that you're 10,000 miles away in Sydney or wherever, however many miles it is, it was like the two places, the UK and Australia, were connected during the Olympics and Paralympics. It was very bizarre. So maybe that was the change in technology, but it was a real feeling of connection, and I think really quite exciting. So the opening ceremony, I think 80,000 people, and again for the closing ceremony with Kylie Minogue performing. It was huge. There was a lot of press and media interest. Every single person who medalled at the Paralympics was interviewed by the BBC. So there was a lot of press and media. So there was a big buzz, probably the biggest buzz. Obviously, the Australians are a sporting mad public. So they were out in enthusiasm. They made sure that there was plenty of people at the stadium. So, yeah, very, very exciting and huge games.
And I mean, so was there really a sort of big difference between Seoul, Barcelona, Atlanta and Sydney, you know, sort of not only for the sort of the coverage and everything else, but also maybe in the athletes and the sort of caliber of athletes coming through?
I think over the period of time, I think. So probably 1980, and again, this is no disrespect. I think what you've probably alluded to is that the, and I use this word with caution, that I think that disability sport, actually the professionalism, the investment, the profile, everything had risen. So obviously throughout the 80s and then into the 2000s and then onwards, the standard of competitiveness, the standard of professionalism, the support from the national lottery to British athletes in particular, but also many of the Eastern Bloc athletes were being funded by their government. So the actual standard and the parity of support between sort of able-bodied athletics and disabled athletics meant the standard was rising. So the professional standard. So I guess for me, if you look at it, the measure would be that the world records. So pretty much everybody in my event, if you take the shot put, pretty much everything in my event, in my category, in the shot put, broke the world record that would have stood, the standing world record from the early 80s when I started. So that's the sort of like the significance that, you know, it's of improvement throughout the years.
And Sydney was your last games, wasn't it? How did that sort of feel?
Yeah, it was. I did go to the European Championships the year after, but it was my last Paralympics. But it's all in the time. It's in the timing. It was a really good thing to do, and then you move on to do other things. So it's obviously a disappointment at the time. Obviously, I had lots of excellent friends and colleagues from the Paralympics, and then. Still have the same friends and colleagues, which is, 20 odd years later.
And when we look back from Sydney to the London 2012 Paralympic Games and post-London to Paris this year, I mean, we have seen a big change, not only in people's engagement in the Paralympics, but the coverage has got better over the years. And in some ways, you know, the Olympics are a bit of a warm-up to the Paralympics, aren't they?
Yes, that's the way you have to look at it. It's the pre-show. Yeah.
And Jonathan, what track have you chosen that marks your time at the Sydney 2000 Paralympic Games, and why this particular track?
So this is from my wife. So she wasn't my wife then. She was I should say girlfriend. So my girlfriend at the time. one of our first dates was to go and see the film Notting Hill, and she recorded a good luck message with some added messages at the time, and she ended the tape. This is on a tape, it's on a cassette, so it sort of dates me a little bit. So she recorded a cassette, if people can actually remember what cassettes are. So I had a cassette to listen to in my Walkman. So she, a good luck message and a supportive message, and she chose to finish it off from Notting Hill, You Say It Best When You Say Nothing At All, Ronan Keating. And we had this sung at our wedding in 2003 by a friend, Claire.
The touch of your hand says you'll catch me wherever I fall. You will say it best when you say nothing at all.
Ronan Keating there, and When You Say Nothing At All, and a track that obviously means quite a lot to you, Jonathan, not only for Sydney, but also playing at your wedding too. We now move to the sort of the COVID-19 pandemic, which started back in the early spring of 2020, and very different and strange times that they were too back then, with the lockdowns, social distancing, and only being allowed out for an hour, if I can remember correctly, in the first lockdowns. For you as a sportsman and somebody who's keen on sort of being active, that must have been quite hard, because all the gyms were closed and we only allowed out for an hour a day, which must have been difficult for you, because I know you've run marathons as well.
So I moved on. So I have to be honest, I probably was out for a little bit longer than Boris said we should be out for. So, and I can tell you a story. So I live very close to the beach, and I tend to go out very early in the morning. So I go out about 5 o'clock to go out for a morning run, thinking that actually I can have the beach to myself. And you remember the early days of lockdown, that there was the swerve, and obviously swerving and social distancing when you don't see that well is quite a manoeuvre, if you people can remember that way. But there's lots of discussion on how to do that. So I'm running at 5 o'clock in the morning, gone out to avoid everybody. I run on Folkestone Beach, and that's a large expanse of sand when the tide's out. So I go down there because I don't have to think. There's no holes. It's flat. I don't run into anything. I can just run round and round in circles, and there's nothing to fall over or run into. And I was at 5 o'clock in the morning on a beach that's totally deserted, and I managed to run into one other person who have no idea where they came from. So it's a very bizarre set of coincidences that for me, which I didn't think would happen. But the reason I chose this piece of music was because I always think I heard a story about what's called a strawberry moment. And a strawberry moment was told to me by a psychologist, a sports psychologist. And he said, no matter however stressed you become, there's also a moment that you can reach for, a moment of clarity, a moment of relaxation. And he said, the way you have to think about it, he said that the story is the mouse is running away from the fox, and the mouse is running and running and running, and the fox is getting closer and closer, and the mouse falls over a cliff and is hanging on to a piece of grass by one hand, and he suddenly notices that next to him is a wild strawberry plant, and with his one hand that's free, he stretches out and picks up the wild strawberry and he pops it in, and it's the best tasting strawberry he's ever had. And I think in that moment of stress, it's finding something that's going to be give you an instant pleasure. And for me, my strawberry moment came in COVID. Like you say, we were restricted. We couldn't go out. We were washing down every piece of shopping that came into the house. I have a trampoline in the garden, so I spent a lot of money on buying a trampoline. Well, not a lot of money, but I've spent money on a trampoline that takes my weight. And I had Bluetooth headphones on, and I was bouncing along, and I had my music on random, and Aaron Copland's Simple Gifts came on, and it was that moment of pure relaxation, of just being in that moment with all this going on in the background, of being free, bouncing up from the trampoline, and actually hearing this very quiet, peaceful music, which just says, enjoy the moment, really. and take that moment. And just it was just a case of my strawberry moment of taking me way away from everything else that was going on. It may have only lasted for 30 seconds or a minute, but it was just that moment of pure nothing else really matters, and this is a really joyous moment of music and connection with the world around me.
Simple Gifts Fair by Aaron Copland, and a track that marks moments for you, Jonathan, in lockdown. We now come to your final track, Jonathan, the one that you would like to pass on that might sort of either inspire people or give them hope for the future. What is the track and why have you chosen it?
Meatloaf, and it's A Kiss is a Terrible Thing to Waste. And for me, it's the lyric. I worked with one of my team about 30 years ago, a lady called Janice. She was our office administrator, and she said that she meets lots of people who say, "I could have done that. If only I'd done this." So for me, I was sitting on a train commuting to London again. Music on. I had set Apple Music. Other providers are available, but it was. On random, I never really, as a rule, would listen to Meat Loaf, and this song came on, "A Kiss is a Terrible Thing to Waste," and it talks about the two loneliest words, "if only." And for me, I think it goes right back to the beginning of our conversation. It's about having somewhere to jump off. It's going in with two feet and actually taking your opportunities when you can, not thinking of what could happen or what could go wrong. It's just about reaching out and just grabbing the opportunities and taking to it. And I think this song, as you listen to more and more, every time I listen to it, I think, yeah, this is a song that inspires. It's about, you know, not thinking I can't. It's about thinking I can and I will, and I just got to give it a go. And if nothing good comes of it, well, I can just, you know, say I gave it my best shot. And I think if you're entering any sort of sporting event or any life event, really, it's about sort of grabbing those opportunities with two hands, giving it a go, and just doing the very best you can, and just saying, then you can just say, yep, I gave it a go, and not thinking, if only, as in the words of the song.
What a lovely moment to end. Well, thank you very much indeed, Jonathan Ward, for sharing your tracks of my life with me here on RNIB Connect Radio.
It's a pleasure.
There's a feast waiting for you and you've never even gotten a taste. It's later than you.